For another take on recent research developments in lung cancer, including data reported at the recent 2007 ASCO meeting in Chicago, I met with Dr. Mark Sosinski to find out the most common questions he's receiving from oncologists about management of this disease. Dr. Sosinski began our conversation by discussing the queries he receives about the use of adjuvant systemic therapy.
I think there are two major ones in adjuvant therapy. The first one is, what do you do with the node-negative patients? You know, there's been controversy since ASCO of 06 about the role of chemotherapy in the 1B patient. And this comes up quite a bit because, you know, node-negative T2 disease is pretty common out there in terms of those patients who get resected. These patients were included in the big positive trials, although the subset analysis of the big trials were negative. I am very, I don't want to say skeptical, but I don't put a lot of weight on the subset analysis that were not powered to show the difference. So if the trial had the eligibility criteria of stage 1B to 3A and the trial was positive, then to me, the patients between 1B and 3A are eligible for that treatment. The subsequent subset analysis, as we've mentioned, have not been positive in the 1B, but they weren't necessarily powered to show a difference in a group of patients that is going to be tougher to show a difference because they have fewer events. I think the potential benefit in the adjuvant setting for the 1B patients, we will ultimately prove is as good as it is in the twos and the threes in terms of risk reduction.
Relative risk reduction. Which is what we've seen in breast and colon.
Absolutely. And so I'm banking on precedent in other solid tumors that we'll see the same thing. So if you have a patient that you think is a good candidate for adjuvant therapy and they have a 1B tumor, I think it's not unreasonable to give that patient treatment. We know on the next intergroup trial they will include the 1Bs, but they have to be bigger than 4 centimeters. But that would actually entail a lot of the 1Bs that were there. So I have an honest chat with the patient, and I tell the docs, you have to talk to the patient and say, you know, the trials did include you in there. They were positive trials. I think getting 3 or 4 cycles of platinum-based, I prefer cis. Not everyone is a great cis candidate. I do use carbo in certain patients. That given our level of supportive care, that we can get patients through 3 to 4 cycles, the rates of mortality with good management and attentive management, I think, are far less than 1% in these trials.
And these docs, of course, are used to using adjuvant therapy in pretty low-risk situations.
Absolutely.
Particularly in breast cancer, where a lot of women are going to get chemo for 10% absolute risk of failure. I'm guessing that based on that precedent, you might get some cases sent to you sometime where maybe the tumor is 2.5 centimeters or
right.
2 centimeters, but the patient's 60 years old and just, you know, a rock in great health.
Yeah. You know, this was an easier question when the CLGB trial was positive. Now that it's negative, it becomes a more difficult question. At ASCO 04, when the CLGB was positive, you know, you can make the argument, well, if 3.1 was included in the trial and you have a patient who's 2.8, do we really think that the relative risk reduction is going to be any different? And I would say no. And years ago, I did treat patients who were kind of in that borderline size. Today, I think it's a little harder to be overly aggressive. I've certainly had a couple of patients who have said to me, you know, they've taken this lung cancer out. I know that I'm a 2.9 centimeter because I got a copy of my path report. I will do anything for a 1% benefit. What can you do for me to reduce the likelihood that I'm going to recur and die from my disease? And so I think if you talk with patients, it has to be individualized. I don't push it, but occasionally you have a very motivated patient who you get the sense that if you say, I won't do it, they will go for another opinion and another opinion. And actually, several years ago, I think I was the 4th opinion of a patient in a very similar situation where we ended up saying, okay, we think we can do this. You're obviously motivated to get it. I think there's a little downside to doing it.
You use the term that the trial, quote, turned positive. And kind of looking at this from an outside, I was extremely confused because my understanding was that originally, I guess it was in 2004, they closed the study, I thought because it was positive. And then a couple of years later, they're saying, well, now it's negative. And that kind of didn't make sense to me if they thought it was so strong that they had to close the trial.
Right. I think it's an issue of statistics and how we look at these sorts of things.
I mean, was it like the statistical rules were wrong or what?
No, I don't think the statistical rules were wrong, but the statistical rules operate on the predetermined assumptions that you make, the time course of the events, in this case, deaths that occur, the reasons that deaths may be occurring and all those sorts of issues. And being a member of the Respiratory Committee of CLGB and accruing to the 9633 trial, we knew this was being monitored by the Data Safety and Monitoring Committee. And at an interim analysis, they looked at the data, and it was clearly at that point in time favored the chemotherapy arm of the trial. And so their
judgment. The curves looked pretty impressive.
And the curves were pretty impressive. And ethically, I think with the data that our Data Safety Committee was given, you really couldn't have continued that trial and felt good about it from an ethical point of view. So it was closed. Now, then as time goes on and more events occur, and I will add that even the analysis at ASCO 06 is not the final analysis.
So it could turn positive again?
It could turn positive again. It could remain negative. I think what we saw in that trial is the continued benefit in terms of progression-free survival that I thought was it is statistically significant. I think it's clinically significant. What has happened is that the benefit in overall survival in a relatively small cohort of patients, 343 patients, I think, eroded a little bit. And so the p-value went to, I think, 0.09 or 0.1 or something like that. Now, the hazard ratio, even on the updated one, was about 0.8. Remember, that is better than the hazard ratio for the LACE meta-analysis for the cisplatin-based data, which was about 0.87. So still, for what we accept as a positive hazard ratio for the adjuvant treatment of lung cancer, the CLGB trial still comes in underneath what we see for the cisplatin-based data. But from a statistical point of view, it doesn't achieve that, the conventional level of less than 0.05.
It's really amazing because, I mean, this really changed the way investigators did adjuvant therapy. I'm not so sure about the docs in practice, what they did.
Right. I think it was a source of confusion. It did influence the upcoming intergroup trial with bevacizumab in that they changed their eligibility criteria but did allow the larger 1B patients to be entered.
I guess just to summarize this, it's pretty clear why this might be one of the most common questions that you get because it is quite confusing and maybe a little counterintuitive for a doc who's walking into the next room dealing with a colon cancer patient, next room breast cancer patient, where all these sort of things, same concepts, same issues all the time.
Right. The other question that we get a lot is what to use. The evidence would support principally cisplatinum vinorelbine or cisplatinum etoposide. Those were the two most common regimens that were used in the big international trial. And then we have the Canadian trial and the ANITA trial, which were both vinorelbine-based trials. So, you know, obviously that's where the evidence is. We have plenty of evidence that other regimens are at least equally efficacious as the vinorelbine-based therapy in advanced disease. In the upcoming intergroup trial, we're given a choice of three regimens, the vinorelbine and cisplatinum, gemcitabine, cisplatinum, and docetaxel, cisplatinum. So in my practice, what I've done is taken the stance that, well, if this is good for the cooperative groups, I choose one of them. And I've typically have been using cisgemcitabine just because I find that to be the best tolerated and easiest and more convenient regimen to be given.
What do you think about the docs who say, understanding we don't have a perfect answer to this, that they're going to use cis-docetaxel because it looks more effective in metastatic disease and they bring that down the adjuvant setting?
I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think that's why cis-docetaxel was used in the adjuvant trial, given a choice. I think that recently published in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology was a pilot trial from Sloan Kettering suggesting that, at least in their hands, that's a tough regimen to get. I think it's a perfectly reasonable choice. I just find that regimen to be a bit more toxic in a setting, a post-thoracotomy setting, where these patients are pretty sensitive to toxicity. They tend to have some degree of comorbidities. They've had a big thoracic procedure. We're seeing them 4 to 5 weeks after their operation. They aren't completely bounced back at that point. They aren't the perfect candidate for aggressive therapy. And so that's why I think that that regimen is a particular concern of mine just because of the level of toxicity. But I think it's a reasonable choice if you can get it in.
What other questions in the adjuvant setting do you get?
The other big one is what to do with the ignored mediastinum. You as an oncologist are sent a patient by someone, whether it be a surgeon of some sort, a radiation oncologist, perhaps their primary care doc, and you review the operative note in the pathology report, and you do not get a good sense of the pathologic status of the regional lymph nodes, which are in the mediastinum. You go back to the CT scan or the PET scan or whatever may be available for you in the preoperative setting, and you can't really make a judgment based upon this level of information about, is this a node negative or node positive patient? I always like to say there's not a breast cancer patient in the country that would have an ignored axilla, that wouldn't have pathologic documentation of node negative or node positive. Yet in lung cancer, we tend to accept this as a standard of care.
How often does that happen?
It's happening less and less. As the word gets out, as we educate our surgical colleagues, as we educate our medical oncologist and adopt the concept of adjuvant therapy, I think we hammer this out in tumor boards and in lectures and those sorts of things, that gone are the days where it doesn't make a difference. Now I think it does make a difference in terms of not only good cancer therapy, but also knowing the stage of the patient, being able to make a recommendation, knowing what the prognosis is going to be without adjuvant chemotherapy and with adjuvant chemotherapy. And personally, if you have extensive N2 disease, I think it brings up the question of whether or not you use postoperative radiotherapy in those patients. And so I think there are lots of issues that maybe, 10 years ago, we weren't necessarily seeing these patients because we weren't giving adjuvant therapy. But now things have changed, and I think that, what to do. I tend to err, if you've got a larger tumor, if you've got a 4 or 5 centimeter tumor, and you've got a either unsampled or inadequately sampled mediastinum, then I almost have to consider routinely that it's positive and bet with the patient and say, if I knew they were positive, I'd definitely give you adjuvant therapy. Your tumor is 4 or 5 centimeters anyway, so you're in a group of patients that I would probably do this. We tend to discuss them in our multidisciplinary thoracic conference. And, the radiotherapists often bring up the idea of, if you're assuming this is negative, is there a role for postoperative radiotherapy in those patients? So that is really a conundrum in thoracic oncology right now, is when you're stuck in that situation, what's the right thing to do?
Do you have any sense of how often these types of procedures are being done by general surgeons and how they stage patients as opposed to a surgical oncologist?
Yeah, I think that there are generally three types of surgeons that are operating on lung cancer. We've got the general surgeons, we've got cardiac surgeons whose primary interest is really in coronary disease and valves and those issues. And then we have real trained thoracic surgeons who just do thoracic surgery. I think, it varies tremendously based upon your geography. I hesitate to say this because I think some place there was someone in a lecture or a paper somewhere who says that there's almost no one in the United States who isn't about an hour and a half to 2 hours from a real thoracic surgeon or someone who does dedicated thoracic procedures. So the access to real thoracic surgeons who are trained to at least do systematic sampling, perhaps dissection, or at least to pay attention to the regional lymph nodes so you have some idea. The reality of it is that there's a significant proportion. I think it may vary from center to center. Being from University of North Carolina and one of our major hospitals in the area, there's actually, up until recently, and I mean in the last 6 months or so, there was not a board-certified thoracic surgeon on staff operating on these patients.
Wow.
And this hospital is in close proximity to University of North Carolina, Duke University, where there's a cadre of real thoracic surgeons. So I think the quality of the surgery, the approach to the preoperative staging, to the intraoperative staging is very important in the care of these patients. And we shouldn't allow our thoracic patients to have any less of a, kind of very dedicated approach to the cancer operation. And part of the dedication to that and the importance of that is addressing the status of the regional nodes.
Before we go on to stage 3 disease, I've got to guess that another common question you must get is the issue of the non-smoker in the adjuvant setting. Would you consider erlotinib off study?
Right. Yeah, the non-smoker comes up.
Although I don't know in North Carolina how many non-smokers you have.
Actually, I think we are the leading accrual site on the CLGB non-smoker trial, which is amazing. And most people would assume that we wouldn't be. But yeah, that is a common question. It is a small percentage of the patients, probably in the range of 10% or so. It's been my experience that I will admit, and I don't have data to back this up, many of the non-smokers tend to present with more advanced disease, at least in my experience, and so it's less of an issue in the adjuvant setting.
Is there any data on that?
I haven't seen any data, and I've been meaning to ask people like Vince Miller and Passiani and those sorts of people, but I'd be interested to see data in that regard. Now, it may be that I'm a medical oncologist and the patients that I see are the patients that are, more advanced disease, but at least that's been my experience thus far. I have, in the absence of data, and in the wake of S0023, in which the use of an EGFR TKI after chemo radiotherapy actually showed decreased survival, I've been very conservative in my approach to that. These patients There was no reason why these patients weren't included on the positive adjuvant trials, although I've not seen any data broken out specifically for non-smokers in those trials. I give them adjuvant chemotherapy. I have not yet given anybody adjuvant erlotinib or gefitinib in the old days. We do have an outstanding prematurely stopped trial by the NCI of Canada in which adjuvant gefitinib was studied. It was closed before it met its accrual goal, but we don't have any information from that as of yet. So I've pondered it.
Of course, that was non-selected patients.
Right. Right. We have an adjuvant trial ongoing now, the RADIANT trial, which selects patients who are EGFR positive by immunohistochemistry or FISH analysis, where you can give them chemotherapy or not, and then they're randomized to a placebo or erlotinib. And I think till we see some data from that trial, I've not used it as a recommended treatment.
How do you think the rash is going to play out in the adjuvant setting if, in fact, erlotinib works in these patients, whether it's EGFR mutations or non-smokers?
You know, as time goes on, I think we all become more comfortable with the rash, the time course of the rash, and the management of the rash. I do think that, like most toxicities, if you implement an aggressive prospective management of any toxicity, then you can lessen the toxicity to a certain degree. And that's certainly been our experience. And we have to remember that the rash that most people get concerned about is the acute acneiform that occurs relatively early. It flares. It has a bit of a burnout aspect to it. It is typically managed by acneiform sorts of approaches. And that tends to be less of an issue. What tends to be an issue on more chronic administration is the dry skin, the pruritus that occurs with that, the paronychial type of issues that go on. And we get patients through them. I think that those are not prohibitive. And I think if we're aggressive with moisturizers and other things, that it won't be a showstopper in the majority of patients. There have been very few patients that we have had to stop erlotinib on. And typically, we're obviously using the metastatic setting. But there are very few patients we have to stop specifically for toxicity.
Let's talk a little bit about locally advanced disease and chemoradiation therapy and that whole scenario. What are the most common questions, and maybe what are the questions in particular you're getting since ASCO? I'm guessing you're getting a lot of them.
Well, I mean, obviously ASCO this year brought us the data about the Hoosier Oncology Group study that evaluated the role of consolidation docetaxel. Remember, that was a platform that SWOG had championed in a single-arm phase 2 trial, which looked pretty good, but they were highly selected patients, and it really stood on its own. It had really not been validated. The HOG trial suggested that there was little, if any, contribution to consolidation docetaxel except for toxicity. That platform of chemorads with cisplatin etoposide followed by docetaxel had been widely used after the results of 9504 were available over the past 3 to 5 years. I think this is going to make the average guy in practice kind of rethink what they do. I personally was never a big fan of the 9504 approach. I was waiting for another group to validate it. I was waiting for the Hoosier Oncology Group trial. And the issue nowadays is docs are wondering, if they aren't going to pursue that strategy, what should they be doing? You know, my sense in stage 3 disease is that there are really two major hurdles that we face. One is control of intrathoracic disease, which is typically bulky. And the second is control of occult micrometastatic disease, which almost all these patients have. So my thinking is that we need aggressive local regional therapy and we need good systemic therapy. Good systemic therapy to me is platinum-based treatment. And I like to think of it in terms of delivering what you think is the equivalent of 4 cycles. Whether you give the chemotherapy during radiation, either full dose systemic or low dose concurrent, I think is another controversy that has never been addressed in a randomized trial. We know that full dose concurrent really would treat the systemic disease as well as be radioenhancing at the same time, but it's more toxic. A lot of docs like the low dose weekly sorts of strategies, which probably only helps radiosensitization, is not a very good systemic treatment. And therefore, if you're doing the low-dose approaches, I've been an advocate of either giving chemotherapy before induction or afterwards consolidation. But we don't have enough randomized comparative data to tell us what the optimal strategy is in stage 3 disease.
But in terms of the adjuvant, or what I would call the adjuvant part of this, or the consolidation part of this, how many cycles and what type of regimen would you be comfortable with, whether it's given before, during, or after?
Yeah, again, it gets back to thinking about it in terms of what you think might be the equivalent of four cycles of therapy. I mean, what we've typically done at our institution, we have held on to the strategy of induction for two cycles, followed by concurrent. We use weekly carboplatin and paclitaxel. We have been interested in the radiotherapy aspects of treatment and more aggressive doses. Our kind of standard dose, either on or off a clinical trial, is 74 gray. And that's really only being studied with low-dose weekly chemotherapy. So that's kind of why we use the low-dose approach. So what we've typically done is the two cycles of induction followed by the 7 weeks of low-dose carboplatin and paclitaxel.
Any other questions that you get about these patients?
There are lots of questions about the role of surgery in selected subsets. I have looked at the data evaluating the role in N2 disease, and my interpretation of the two phase 3 trials that really studied this is that they were negative for surgery. So as a standard of care, I think the vast majority of these 3A or 3B patients are best served with non-surgical approaches. That doesn't mean that I don't think that there's absolutely no role in any of the patients with 3A disease or the subset of patients with 3B disease who have T4, N0, or N1 disease. It remains investigational in my approach, and I think that we need to do some studies to try to figure out, is there a segment of the population that would benefit from a surgical resection if you could get away with doing lesser surgery and not a pneumonectomy? For instance, if you had a N2 positive patient that you gave induction, either chemotherapy or chemoradiotherapy to, and you restaged the mediastinum and you were convinced that the mediastinum was sterilized, but there was persistent bulk disease in a lobe that could undergo a lobectomy, I think there a surgery could benefit that subgroup of patients by taking out disease that chemoradiotherapy is not going to sterilize because of the bulk of the disease. That's one example.
You've done that yourself?
Yes, we have actually done that on a couple of patients when we were convinced that we had thought we had sterilized the mediastinum, but there was persistent disease. And so far, those have been good outcomes. There are challenges with that in terms of evaluating the mediastinum after induction therapy. We have a number of new technologies out there, endobronchial ultrasound, endoscopic ultrasound. How to use PET scan still is somewhat uncertain at that time. And sometimes we've actually had a situation where we initially documented the presence of N2 disease by endoscopic ultrasound. We were able to do a first mediastinoscopy after all induction therapy was done. And so we've pursued that strategy in a few patients.
Interesting. Let's switch to stage 4 disease. And again, the common questions that you receive.
I view stage 4 disease in the good performance status patient is really three major groups of patients. The patients who should get bevacizumab, the patients who shouldn't get bevacizumab, and then the never smokers. And as a general way, those are the three groups of patients. It's interesting to me to talk to docs across the U.S. in terms of the percentages of patients in their practice that they think are eligible to receive bevacizumab. There's been a very wide spectrum of this, from about the 20% range to about the 60 to 70% range. Obviously, the issues we deal with is how much hemoptysis is too much hemoptysis. We go searching for brain mets, typically with MRI nowadays, that we didn't necessarily do 5 years ago if a patient were asymptomatic, and you end up finding a lot of asymptomatic brain mets. We struggle with the histologic issues in a setting where many of our diagnoses are made on fine needle aspirations, and we can't get a histologic diagnosis. So there are some issues there. What other factors might predict for serious hemorrhage of bevacizumab? The one I worry about is baseline cavitation on a CT scan when you first see a patient, which actually may be a surrogate marker for squamous histology anyway. So,
what about the development of cavitation once the patient's been treated?
Yeah, we worry about that, and we've actually seen that in a couple of our patients. We have continued the bevacizumab, and so far we have not been burned by that kind of strategy. I think that obviously, in my mind, cavitation implies dying tumor. And so cavitation is actually a good thing. And so we continue on with treatment. We've not been in a situation where we've had cavitation that then preceded either a very serious or fatal pulmonary hemorrhage. Knock on wood, that doesn't happen. But I think that that's what people get concerned about. I don't know that there's a right answer in that patient. I guess one could consider, interrupting systemic treatment for a while to give radiotherapy to that area to reduce the risk of pulmonary bleeding. However, I'm not sure we have data about how good of a prophylactic strategy that is yet. So in the absence of knowing what to do, we've in that setting, which hasn't happened too many times, but we've kind of continued on with the treatment.
I would guess another question that you might get is the question of what do you do when you start somebody on chemo, Bev, and then you stop the chemo, for how long do you continue the Bev?
Afterwards.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in ECOG 4599, it was supposed to continue to progression. One of the philosophical debates we often have is the benefit of bevacizumab or anti-angiogenic drugs maximized in the presence of chemo, and you don't get much after the chemo is stopped. And we've had a few trial designs where the bevacizumab is stopped when the chemo is stopped and those sorts of things. You know, I don't think we have an answer. In my practice, what I've done is, you know, I am a believer in that if you do a phase 3 trial and it's positive, that when you translate that into practice, you should do it as they did it in the phase 3 trial. So I have continued on my patients on bevacizumab after I've stopped, and I've typically used carboplatin. There have been a number of patients who have gotten out to 8, 10, 12 cycles in which we're beginning to wonder, patients are doing well, the disease seems to be controlled, how much benefit am I really getting from continuing this every 3 weeks and so on and so forth. And I often wonder if there might be just as much benefit of bevacizumab if you were to interrupt therapy and then perhaps reinstitute bevacizumab when you end up treating that patient in the second line setting.
Now, it hasn't been very long since ASCO, but I'm sure you're getting questions about the AVAIL study that was presented there, looking at CIS, GEM, plus or minus BEV, but they're also looking at two different dose levels.
Right.
And the question of, well, what's the right dose at this point? How do you answer that?
Well, as a purist, the AVAIL trial wasn't designed to address the dose question, but I'm unaware of any oncologist who won't draw conclusions about the dose question. There are lots of problems with regard to the design of that trial and the conduct of that trial. I think how I interpret AVAIL is that it's a positive trial. It's a second positive trial, that the use of bevacizumab in combination with cisplatin and gemcitabine appears to be safe, and that both the 7.5 and 15 did improve the primary endpoint of progression-free survival. The 7.5 milligram dose did not appear to be less toxic, in my opinion, and therefore I have continued to use 15 based upon the survival results of 4599. Now, I would bet that at least by ASCO 08 that we will see some survival data from the AVAIL trial, and maybe that will make us change our mind about the dosing questions. But I think for right now, in the absence of survival data in that trial, I've stuck with the dose of 15 milligrams per kilogram when I use the drug.
What about the issue of the patient then progressing while they're on Bev alone? How do you determine what to do at that point?
What I've generally done is stop the bevacizumab and gone on to whatever I'm going to use in the second line setting. I think that's a great research question. My understanding is that Corey Langer through ECOG may be addressing that question in a randomized phase 2 where patients get Bev with first line treatment. They continue on with Bev when they progress. The Bev is either stopped in second line treatment is given or the Bev is continued with second line treatment. And I think that's a very nice design to answer an important question. There is some encouraging data from the Herbst-Sandler study where they looked at chemo versus chemo with Bev or Bev with erlotinib in a randomized phase 2 and suggested that there seems to be an effect of bevacizumab in the second line setting. However, those patients were bevacizumab naive patients at the time they got Bev for the first time. So I think we have to be careful about drawing too many conclusions from that trial about continuing Bev with your second line treatment.
What about the combination of Bev and erlotinib, both in terms of the research issues? I know you're looking at this in the stage 3 setting.
Absolutely, yeah.
And also in terms of non-protocol therapy. Can you kind of review that whole arena?
Right. I think the attractiveness of combining erlotinib and bevacizumab is they target two kind of new pathways and validated pathways. Each of them by themselves have been shown to improve survival. So the attractiveness of combining them is that it's a novel targeted approach. It gets away from some of the traditional toxicities we get with regular chemotherapy. I think it makes biologic sense to do it. The initial data we had from MD Anderson and Vanderbilt was very encouraging. That data was moved into a randomized phase 2, which actually suggested, again, that Bev added to chemo or added to erlotinib did better than chemo alone. It also suggested that the combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab looked as good with less toxicity than the chemo bevacizumab. So I think it really opens up the possibility that in some patients, they may be better served with a non-cytotoxic approach, combining these novel targeted agents. Now, I don't think the jury's out on that. We've got some phase 3 trials that are ongoing that are going to answer this question in terms of that combination. And we also have to remember that we may be able to identify with various biomarkers patients who, at least from the erlotinib point of view, may be best candidates for that approach.
Can you talk a little bit about your study? It's looking at not just Bev and erlotinib, but also that combined with chemo and radiation therapy.
Yeah, so we have, realizing that both bevacizumab and erlotinib were important drugs in stage 4 disease, we thought that there was a rationale for combining both of them with chemo radiotherapy. Both of them in preclinical data have been radiation sensitizers. And so we designed a trial in which we maintained the induction and concurrent aspect of it using carboplatin and Taxol for both the induction and concurrent in 74 gray of radiation. What we did was add bevacizumab to the induction treatment, as well as giving bevacizumab every 2 weeks during chemo radiotherapy. Once we established in the first cohort that we could do that safely, we added in the erlotinib in a sequenced fashion during radiotherapy. And that's gone actually pretty well also thus far. We haven't had excessive toxicity. We have certainly seen our share of esophagitis, except for one patient. We've not seen any grade 4 or 5 hemorrhages. We've had a single case of grade 3 hemorrhage that was successfully managed and the patient completed all of their treatment. So our initial experience is that you can combine these safely with aggressive chemo radiotherapy. The jury's not quite out on that. We've got kind of the phase 2 portion to complete in this to look at safety and efficacy.
How many people have been through it so far?
16.
And no obvious problems in terms of side effects, toxicity?
The only comment that I will make is that I think that one has to be careful about the radiation parameters. We have a excellent group of radiation oncologists. We limit the volume of lung that gets over 20 gray, the so-called V20. We pay particular attention to how much esophagus is in the field. We have seen our share of esophagitis. We have not seen any fistula problems. You know, the small cell experience has been plagued with the development of TE fistulas and bleeding. We've not had that experience thus far. And so far, so good. Certainly, I do not think that combining bevacizumab with chemo radiotherapy is ready for prime time yet. I think we have to kind of sort out the safety issues first. The Southwest Oncology Group has a very important trial, I think, incorporating bevacizumab onto the, for better or for worse, the SWOG 9504 platform. But again, I think there needs to be multiple efforts. Since there's not consensus in stage 3 about what the best strategy is, there need to be multiple efforts to incorporate these drugs into the chemo radiotherapy platform.
What other questions do you get for metastatic disease?
What to do in never smokers? You know, the never smokers represent about 10% of the population.
How about oligosmokers?
In my experience, you know, if you use the cutoff of 10 to 15 pack years or so, it's probably another 10% or so. So we're talking in 1 in 5 patients that you're going to see in practice fall into this category. It's not insignificant when you think of the numbers of lung cancers that we see. The one thing that I am convinced of in that population is that anti-EGFR therapy seems to be important. This seems to be a disease that is much more driven by the EGFR pathway, probably has fewer molecular aberrations out there, such as KRAS mutations and others. And the data we have thus far in the first and second line, either using EGFR TKIs in combination with chemo or EGFR TKIs as single agent, suggests that the survival impact that's seen in that population is quite significant. The hazard ratios are kind of in the 0.4 range. So to me, it tells me that in the drug we have available now is erlotinib should be used relatively early. The questions that I struggle with in the never smoker is that many of them are eligible for Avastin. So what do you do in that setting? Are they an erlotinib patient? Are they an Avastin patient? What's the role of chemotherapy?
How about both?
I was just going to get to that because I think the choices are to give these patients chemotherapy with Avastin, and then as we are supposed to continue the Avastin, perhaps add Tarceva to it. We have a lot of safety information. I don't think you're going to harm patients by doing that. Maybe they should get, if they are not a Avastin candidate, let's say they have brain mets, then the question is it chemo followed immediately in kind of a maintenance strategy with Tarceva? Is it chemo with Tarceva, or is it Tarceva alone? In the CLGB, we have a trial running that randomizes these patients to erlotinib alone versus carbotax plus erlotinib. So two of those three possibilities are being explored in the CLGB trial. I guess you could have argued what we should have done in CLGB is give four cycles of chemo followed immediately by erlotinib, or maybe just chemo alone as a control arm. But again, there's only so much you can do in a randomized phase two to sort out these issues. But I think the never smoker really is a different patient. Their disease is, I think, more EGFR dependent. And the incorporation of anti-EGFR strategies earlier is, I think, important in these patients.
What are your thoughts about nab-paclitaxel? Some of that work's come out of your place. I know you have some experience with it. There's a lot of interest in it in breast cancer, not just because of the advantages in terms of not needing pre-medications and shorter infusions, but the hints that we're starting to see that maybe it has greater efficacy than the other taxanes.
Absolutely. I think the breast data has encouraged me to be somewhat optimistic about nab-paclitaxel. First of all, it is a less toxic drug and an easier drug in terms of infusion times and stuff like that. So I think that that in and of itself is an advantage. I think that probably if you asked many people in breast cancer years ago, would it be a better drug? I think they probably would have said no, but the data is what the data is, and it suggests that it may be a more active preparation of the agent compared to the parent compound or compared to other taxanes. You know, the data in lung cancer thus far is really limited to phase two trials, most of them single arm trials and not comparative trials. So there is a plan to do a large phase three trial comparing carbotaxol to carbonab-paclitaxel. And we would see from that trial if there's any hints of efficacy in terms of the use of nab versus the parent compound.
Can you comment on the paper looking at docetaxel carbo in the adjuvant setting? It was a phase two study that you were involved with.
Yeah. Many years ago, in fact, we're just preparing the manuscript. Several years ago, right when the adjuvant data was breaking and the CLGB data was breaking, we thought that there was room for exploration of other doublets in terms of their feasibility. Obviously, we weren't in the position to do a randomized trial, and I'm unaware of any randomized trial that are going to be comparing doublets in the adjuvant setting. But one of the issues with cisplatin-based treatment in the adjuvant setting is that, A, not everyone is a great candidate for a cisplatin-based therapy. B, we know that with a cisplatin-based therapy that the ability to complete three or four cycles is limited. You know, in the studies, it was anywhere from 50 to 70% of patients actually got through the treatment. We thought that there was room for exploration of other agents. Carboplatin is a better tolerated platinum. It may be less active in stage four disease, but even if cisplatin is more active, if you can't get it in, then why does it matter if it's more active? Maybe a slightly less active agent that you can deliver is going to be as good as a slightly more active agent that you can't really deliver effectively. So we really wrote a feasibility study looking at carboplatin and docetaxel. And our endpoint was just, could we get four cycles of therapy in within 12 weeks in more than 80% of the patients? And that was really it. So we studied 72 patients, and we showed that 80% of patients could get four cycles. We did allow patients to get growth factor support. I think about a third of patients ended up getting growth factors at some point during the four cycles. We had no treatment-related deaths. And so we think our conclusions are is that this is a feasible regimen for the patient that you think is not a great candidate for a cisplatin-based approach. I will add that, interestingly, recently our colleagues from Memorial Sloan Kettering published a paper, I think Jerry Azzoli is the first author, in which they looked at cisplatin docetaxel in the adjuvant setting, either every 3 weeks or weekly, and closed the study early because of toxicity issues in this setting. So it was interesting to compare and contrast carboplatin docetaxel being, we think, a very well-tolerated regimen, and our colleagues from Sloan Kettering telling us that cisplatin docetaxel, at least in their hands and in their patient population, was difficult to deliver in that setting.
It's surprising because so many people use that regimen, and you don't hear that much about it.
You don't, and it makes me wonder how much experience we really have with that particular regimen, because other than the Sloan Kettering published experience, I've not seen other data in this setting. Obviously, we're going to see it in the intergroup trial, in which that's a choice, and many people will choose it. But I have a bit of apprehension about the intergroup trial, as I have from the beginning. One of my concerns about the intergroup trial was at least early on, they were going to exclude the one regimen, carboplatin, that we thought Bev was safe with, and we didn't have really safety data with all the other regimens. I think as time goes on, certainly with CISGEM, we have some safety data. We don't necessarily have any safety data with the other regimens, and I think it has to be monitored carefully in terms of the toxicity.
Getting back to the carbo docetaxel regimen, where do you see that heading in terms of adjuvant therapy?
We're submitting the manuscript very shortly, and I think that, you know, if we are willing to accept the use of docetaxel-based therapy in the intergroup setting, I think with our feasibility study, you know, it opens the possibility is that, let's say that you were convinced that docetaxel was a better drug than, say, vinorelbine based upon the TAX-326 data. However, you saw a patient that you really didn't want to give cisplatin to. We have feasibility data in 72 patients that you can give this regimen. You may have to support it with growth factor. That's not such a bad thing. But you can get 80% of your patients through four cycles within 12 weeks, with no mortality, at least in our experience. And so I think that it creates enough of a phase two safety platform to suggest that you could use that regimen. The data was very similar in our trial as I thought the CLGB showed with carboplatin and Taxol. So there's a theme here that carbo-based therapy is feasible. We won't wrestle with the efficacy issues of it. But again, I get back to what I said before. Not every patient with resected lung cancer is the perfect patient for cisplatin-based therapy. And I think carboplatin is a reasonable alternative.
Getting back to stage four disease, what about the issue of second-line therapy? Then you must get a lot of questions about choosing it.
Yeah, not only choosing it, but timing it. You know, how do you follow patients that you've treated in the first-line setting? We had a very interesting trial at ASCO this year, the trial that Panos Fidias presented about if you give four cycles, and their design was either to give immediate docetaxel or to give docetaxel per the standard of care, which is wait to the time of progression. Their ability to deliver second-line therapy was much higher in the immediate group than it was in the delayed group. We know if you let the natural history of this disease play out, things happen. And patients who are good treatment candidates become marginal or no treatment candidates based upon declining performance status, disease-related events, for instance, having a big pulmonary embolus and your performance status goes downhill and all that kind of stuff. So we know that second therapy works, but it can only work if you can get it in. So this raised in my mind post-ASCO about how do you follow patients after the 4 to 6 cycles? What do you institute second-line therapy for? I've traditionally been, I don't consider myself an over-tester. I don't do a lot of x-rays and CAT scans and stuff like that following patients. I do see them every 4 to 6 weeks. And I think you can tell a lot just by a patient's appetite, their pain level, their chest x-ray, those sort of the simple things. And I use CT sparingly. But I tend to think that obviously you're not going to benefit a patient with second-line therapy if they end up not being a good treatment candidate. So this trial also suggested that the time to disease progression was much better if you gave second-line therapy earlier. And there was a trend toward improved survival in this setting. You know, again, we know second-line therapy improves survival, but if you don't get it, you're not going to live longer. The issue is with choice. And I really think the main issue is, are you going to use a cytotoxic? And in that setting, the two approved regimens, pemetrexed and docetaxel, I think pemetrexed is the preferred cytotoxic because it works as well and is less toxic and easier to give. Or you're going to give erlotinib, which is the TKI that's approved for second and third line. I myself have typically used mostly clinical selection factors in patient preference to guide that decision. We don't have any comparative data yet comparing Alimta to erlotinib. We do have a trial that's being launched in the cooperative group setting that will address trying to look for a biomarker about who should get what. But I have used the clinical selection factors, smoking status, histology, gender, in patient preferences. You know, some patients prefer not to continue with IV therapy. They like the concept of a pill. Some patients have insurance issues. Their out-of-pocket expenses may be greater with Tarceva versus coming in for an IV infusion. So it's kind of a complicated assessment there. If I knew that clearly one of them was better in this particular patient, then I would do that. You know, in reality, Neil, I think my goal is that my patients are going to get both these drugs. They're going to get pemetrexed, they're going to get erlotinib, and we're talking about which one comes first. We're treating patients in the second, third line setting for palliative benefit. You know, if I give 2-3 cycles of pemetrexed and the patient and I aren't convinced they're getting better, I'll switch to erlotinib earlier. Likewise, if I give erlotinib first and after 6 to 8 weeks we aren't seeing, I won't continue that on until I see objective progression. I'm really treating for really palliation of symptoms. And if the patient doesn't say they're better, I'll switch to the other agent. So I like to use the lung cancers like baseball. You get 3 strikes. You get first, second, third line therapy. And the question is, you know, what are you going to use in the second, third line? What sequence of drugs are you going to use in this particular setting? But I do feel very strongly that since we do have 3 lines of approved agents, it's our responsibility as thoracic oncologists to get exposure of the patients. You don't have to look too far down my patient list to find a patient in the second line setting who I thought got great benefit from pemetrexed. Likewise, some patients get great benefit from erlotinib second or third line. So I think that I like to get both drugs in.